We have been processing the tragedy in Texas together. As of this morning, 19 children, two teachers, died during an elementary school shooting yesterday. And that shooting comes less than 2 weeks after a massacre at a grocery store in Buffalo. And on top of all of that, today marks 2 years since Minneapolis police murdered George Floyd, sparking a global outcry. Days of protest against our nation's racism, including here on the streets of our greater Boston cities and towns. We want to make sure to recognize that moment as well. So just a few days after Floyd was killed, Rachel Rollins joined us here on Radio Boston. Then she was Suffolk County DA, and she passionately called out what happened, called for fundamental changes in the way we practice law enforcement, especially with Black communities. Today, Rollins is U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts. A lot has happened in the past 2 years, so we wanted to invite her to reflect on all of it. We caught up with her earlier this week, before this latest tragedy, and I started by playing a bit of her initial reaction in the days after the murder of George Floyd.
Just profound sadness and honestly, just rage, quite frankly. This man has done more in that 8 minutes that he tried, convicted, sentenced, and executed George Floyd. He set back law enforcement at least 50 years by his action.
So she listened to that, and then I asked her, does she still believe that?
I firmly believe that when I said it, and I will say, watching the trial and seeing all of those members of law enforcement come forth and testify against, quite frankly, Derek Chauvin was a positive step in the right direction, because I don't believe, I know, Tiziana, that he does not represent law enforcement. That is not who the overwhelming majority of good men and women that do an honorable job every day and are culturally competent, he doesn't reflect them.
You know, I wondered if you would say that, because, of course, when you said 50 years setback, we didn't yet know what was going to happen in the, you know, days, weeks, months, even, you know, 2 years after that. And I think now, if I had told you that day that less than a year later, Chauvin would be convicted, would you have believed that even possible at that time?
I don't know if I would have, but remember, did you believe he was going to be convicted? Look, I've been the chief law enforcement officer of Suffolk County and now of all of Massachusetts on the federal side. People were afraid that this man was not going to be convicted after we all watched, and we now know it's 9 minutes and 29 seconds, we watched an execution. And there has been, unfortunately, a lot of things that happened after that fact. Amir Locke was Minneapolis. Amir Locke had a license to carry, and there was a no-knock warrant effectuated. He was not the individual that the police were looking for, but Amir Locke was killed when he had a firearm in his hand after a no-knock warrant, meaning they don't knock before they kick the door off the hinges. He had a license to carry. Does the Castle Doctrine apply to Black people?
I don't know what the Castle Doctrine is.
The Castle Doctrine, and I apologize.
That's all right.
There are some sort of relics of old, like the Castle Doctrine, where you are permitted to defend your castle, your home. There are other ones, like we saw with Ahmaud Arbery, where certain states have laws on the books where people can effectuate a citizen's arrest. That's what Travis and Gregory McMichael and Roddy Bryan claimed they were doing falsely with respect to Ahmaud Arbery. So all of these sort of stand your ground, castle doctrine, citizen's arrests, theories and statutes that are on the books, they don't only apply to white people. They apply to everyone if they're on the books. So my point is that there was a murder, quite frankly, a killing of Amir Locke in February in Minneapolis when a no-knock warrant was effectuated and he had a license to carry. If somebody kicks down your door, and I hope they don't, Tiziana, and you have a firearm and a license to carry, you can fire upon those that individual, right? We've seen this happen across the country many, many times where people are defending their home. You know, when we look at Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, George claimed stand your ground. Well, did Trayvon Martin have a right to stand his ground? There are these concepts that we have to start having really uncomfortable conversations where, you know, when does the Second Amendment apply? Does the Second Amendment apply to everyone or only certain people? Does the Castle Doctrine apply to everyone or only certain people? So I think we've gotten a little bit better since George Floyd was murdered, but that summer was awful. We had Ahmaud Arbery. We had Breonna Taylor, which, of course, was a no-knock warrant where she was killed in her home asleep. We had George Floyd, and then recently we've had Buffalo, and there has been some coverage on that, but not as much as other murders that have happened. I've looked at the Globe. There have been on the cover page of the Globe multiple times, which is also a tragedy, is the bicyclist that died in Texas, which we need to hear about that too. 10 people died in Buffalo and were killed by a white supremacist. And there are people that feel as if, are their stories being told? Are we numb to this circumstance? And that's what I get fearful of.
I want to pick up a couple of things. And first, just for listeners, so Amir Locke, that case is February 2nd, 2022. He was fatally shot, so listeners know. And the cyclist is from Vermont, was shot and killed, a competitive cyclist, a woman in Texas. Just for listeners for that. You're talking about it, and I don't mean this dismissively. I mean this very seriously. You're talking about, in part, how we frame the incidents that we're talking about, and that's really resonating. Last Friday, we did a conversation here in Studio 2. Tito Jackson and Joan Vanacki were with us. We were talking about the conversations we need to have in Boston after the Topps grocery store shooting in Buffalo. And Tito Jackson talked a lot about, once again, the language that the media and law enforcement were using to describe the shooter there as an 18-year-old white shooter who was referred to as troubled and isolated and a boy and a teenager.
Right. With mental health issues.
Right. So,
and Michael Brown, who was 18 years old and hadn't killed anyone, was described as an 18-year-old black man.
That's exactly what Tito Jackson was talking about. And the other piece of this, so bear with me for a second. The other piece of this is I remember very vividly that first time we talked with you after George Floyd's murder, that you called it murder then. And I remember being very struck by the fact that as a DA, you were going to come straight out and frame it, call it murder. You're talking about the fact that we've made some progress in the last 2 years, but how we frame things, it sounds like you're saying, still really deeply reveals racism and inequality in how we see incidents that unfold.
I'm not even implying that there's intent there. This is not a malicious statement against the media, but there is not a lot of representation of all people in our media. And there is something that obviously the media sees in the profoundly tragic murder of a woman from Vermont that continues to have that story on the front page of our Globe and other things that unfortunately we don't see when 10 people are murdered by a white supremacist, a self-proclaimed white supremacist, who, oh, by the way, was taken into custody after killing 10 people and harming 3 others without a scratch on him and lived to be held accountable. And I am confident he will be. But if we don't talk out loud about the fact that unarmed people of color and black people in particular die during encounters with police and armed white supremacists live after killing Dylann Roof, after killing 9 people in South Carolina, and this individual after killing 10 people and harming 3 others, 2 of whom were white, because, you know, racism doesn't see color sometimes when they are engaged in their behavior. It's really, really just profoundly sad. And we have to really get comfortable being uncomfortable talking about race and the rise of domestic violent extremism, in particular with respect to race and ethnicity in our country. It's the number one threat, according to the FBI.
So I want to talk about that, too. There are several things I'd like to pick up from there. Since you mentioned the FBI, let's stay there. We know that domestic white extremism is, Homeland Security using a variety of expressions like violent white supremacist extremists. Homeland Security has called them a real terrorist threat, one of the top internet, security threats on American soil. You've just mentioned the FBI. You talked with GBH in a recent report about regional collaboration between agencies regarding right-wing extremist organizations. How is that collaboration working? Are you talking with the FBI as part of that? Have you had conversations directly with them? And what's the approach here in the Commonwealth?
As the chief federal law enforcement officer in our state, I speak to the FBI all the time. They are essentially, one of the largest, if not the leading federal agency that we work with respect to law enforcement. Special Agent in Charge Bonavalenta and I speak often, and we speak, unfortunately, to impacted communities all the time, whether it be the Jewish community, whether it be the Black community. We've had discussions, or I personally have had meetings with other impacted communities, LGBTQIA+, Muslim and Sikh communities as well. What we're doing is we're educating people about the difference between hate incidents and hate crimes, and that there can be civil remedies in some circumstances and criminal remedies in others, and all the different places they can go with the federal government, the state government, or locally if something like that happens. And, I just want to correct one thing you said. Domestic violent extremism, particularly with respect to racial and ethnic extremism, is the number one threat. Not one of the threats. It is the number one threat regarding domestic terrorism in our country. So, it's really important that we talk about that.
So I want to ask you in follow-up to that. Here in Massachusetts, are we clear-eyed? Do we know, do we understand the size and scope of organized white violent extremist groups here in Massachusetts? I think we tend to have a conversation that happens elsewhere and those groups aren't organized here.
I do believe that we often are a little bit naive about what happens here in our Commonwealth. I was the district attorney of Suffolk County when Nathan Allen murdered two Black people in Winthrop after he stole a box truck and crashed it in the beautiful town of Winthrop. And also, I was the DA when a rabbi was stabbed brutally and luckily lived in Brighton. And so those were two cases where we know, one, we've charged it as a hate crime with respect to the rabbi. And Nathan Allen, with his sort of manifesto, for lack of a better word, and what his phone was looking at as he crashed his truck, we know what his intent was there. As the U.S. attorney, we have, unfortunately, several church burning cases in Massachusetts, in Springfield. A historically Black church was burned to the ground, and we just indicted somebody for that. We've seen Jewish facilities, attempted burnings of those facilities as well. And it's really profoundly sad that we are dealing with those types of crimes with that malicious intent in 2020, 2021, and 2022 in Massachusetts.
So what do we do now? 2 years later, renewed attention right now because of the two-year anniversary this week of George Floyd. Mixed results in the progress in America. What's the top priority from your perspective here in the Commonwealth as our U.S. attorney?
The top priority is speaking out about these, educating people about the fact that these things are happening, and then also explaining to communities that feel fear, quite frankly. After the Tops massacre, there are people in Buffalo and there are people here in Massachusetts that might have a loved one in Buffalo or see something of themselves in that community or somebody that was murdered there that are fearful. I think that situation also exposes, now there's a food desert in that community, right? Tops was one of the only supermarkets in that area that sort of catered to the Black community and had prices that were affordable. And so, whether those individuals could or couldn't go to a Trader Joe's or a Whole Foods, we now know more than when the murders occurred back on May 14th, that the individual had gone to Tops multiple times and looked specifically for that location. I want us to be vigilant. I want us to be aware of things that are happening in our community. And I want to make sure as the chief federal law enforcement officer that I'm speaking to impacted communities so that they know that their federal government cares and is going to try to do everything we can to educate you, as well as hold people accountable if they engage in this behavior. But to hear my voice say that the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI and our other state, local, and federal law enforcement officers are actively working to try to disrupt and find people with this ideology before they engage in these acts of violence.
Before we say goodbye to you, I want to ask you a question on one other subject. There's news out recently that you've launched a civil rights investigation into Quincy's resistance to rebuild the Long Island Bridge. What's the thought with that investigation, and can you give us an update on how it's going?
So we did send a letter to Quincy. I paid the mayor the courtesy of a call prior to sending that letter and to alert him that that was going to happen. And what we want to do is just, we read the news just like everyone else. We want to make sure, and it's just an inquiry, we are making no allegations yet, but that there was nothing that ran afoul of the Americans with Disabilities Act. When we think about Quincy, you know, I believe Marina Bay is in Quincy. Was there the same reaction when Marina Bay was erected, for lack of a better word, as there is now with respect to this bridge? We are happy to hear that the mayor has made it clear that he's going to respond to our letter, and we look forward to that discussion, but that will be the extent of my comments.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. The U.S. Attorney, former Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, join us again on this two-year anniversary week of the murder of George Floyd at the hand of Minneapolis police. I appreciated talking to you then, and I appreciate talking to you now.
Absolutely. Be well.